We have come in our study of 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 to the last issue in the large paragraph that we've been looking into that has, quite frankly, to do with how to respond to people who have rejected the apostolic patterns or traditions. And at the end of the letter, it's highly significant, I think, that Paul zeroes in on these people who are in the body who refuse to cooperate, refuse to participate in the tradition which they received from Paul and Silvanus and Timothy. And I think the reason, the big reason for his focus at this point is that there's probably nothing more discouraging to hope than the behavior of our fellow believers. I mean, you know, you get around enough negativism and in a little while you're negative too. So, as we've seen in our studies of this final issue, Paul's clarification of the blessed hope, one of the large factors in losing hope is actually the behavior of other Christians. And under that general thesis, we have these other theses that leaven leavens and hope is critical. And so you have to keep both those realities in mind. Leaven leavens. Paul told the Galatians and the Corinthians that leaven leavens. If you stay in a situation where leaven is working, it will leaven you. And, on the other hand, hope is critical. You can't lose hope without being wiped out by the other factors of your experience. So Paul addresses in this paragraph what Christians are supposed to do when brethren decide to jettison both faith and hope because they've already jettisoned love. In a word, according to verse 6, you're to keep aloof from such ones. And in verse 14, if anyone does not obey our instruction in this letter, take special note of that man and do not associate with him so that he may be put to shame. So this evening what we're going to do is we're going to, instead of reiterating verses 14 and 15, because we've already talked about that multiple times in relation to verse 6 and the rest of the context, we're going to look at verse 13 in particular, because it is, I think, the critical issue of a living hope. I got a new magazine that Dallas Seminary has been putting out. Just they blended a couple of other magazines or whatever and made a new magazine. And one of the things that it contains is what the alumni have been doing. And if an alumnus writes a book and sends notice of it to the seminary, they'll put it in here that he wrote this book. And one of the alumni graduates wrote a book on pastoral burnout. And that's an old theme and issue. But burnout basically is the result of attempting to do an impossible job with inadequate resources. That's what burnout results from. It's kind of like having a 3/4-inch bolt with a nut screwed onto it that has been locked tight for 30 years and it's been rusted and it's on that bolt. And it's your job to take the nut off. And all you have is a pair of pliers with handles about this long, short handle pair of pliers. That's what I call an impossible task with inadequate resources. In a little while, you're going to give up. Because you ain't going to get it off. Ain't no way. There are some of those kind of things that even the biggest pipe wrench I have, which has a handle on it about 30 inches long, won't break loose. So, pliers is... But nonetheless, what we're talking about is being faced with an impossible situation and attempting to address it with inadequate resources. And when we do that, we burn out over time. So, Paul says in that regard that we're not to burn out. We're not to grow weary. Verse 13 says, as for you, brethren, do not grow weary of doing good. The insistence is that you don't burn out. You don't grow weary. But that instruction is given right in this context of this paragraph. So, one of the things I want us to think about is what are the objectives that Paul has in here. Because quite frankly, this growing weary of doing good is a definition or a description of somebody who's given up the hope, which would render 1 and 2 Thessalonians worthless. First and Second Thessalonians are written to sustain our hope, to clarify our hope, to give us hope, to focus on hope. And if we give it up, well, then it just renders those two books as part of, you know, just forget them. And, of course, Paul didn't want them to forget that, because fundamental Christian living requires hope. And when hope dies, the quality of experience in life or experience in our existence dies with it. So, what's Paul's approach to it? Well, verse 13, as for you, brethren, assumes that he's already talked to some others. And that is verse 12. Such persons we command and exhort. But as for you, brethren, and so there are these two groups in the group, in the fellowship of the church. There are these people who are absolutely refusing to follow the traditions which they receive from Paul and Silvanus and Timothy. And in their refusal, they have adapted their needs to sticking their feet under their brother's table at each meal so that they don't have to work for a living and that kind of thing. And the bottom line is that they refuse to be personally responsible for their own needs, and they expect the church to take up the slack and provide for them. So those are the people in verse 12 that are being commanded and exhorting to work. And he said in verse 10, if you don't do this, then you can just starve. That's pretty upfront. So what Paul has done in this paragraph, I think, is he's what I've called, he's created distance. You're not supposed to have anything to do with these people, according to verse 14. Take special note of them. Don't associate with them. Verse 6, keep aloof from every brother who leads this kind of a rebellious or refusal to conform type of life. So what he's actually doing is he's demanding that they create some distance between them and these people who are rejecting the truth. And I want to address that in reverse order. It's pretty clear that what Paul is doing in verses 14 and 15 and telling them again to not associate with these brethren, verse 6 and verse 14 basically say the same thing. Verse 15 sort of clarifies it. So if we took verse 6 and verses 14 and 15, we'd have what they call an inclusio, where you start with an issue and you deal with it and you come back to it at the end. Well, that's what's going on here. And what he's doing is he's creating distance between brethren. He's saying, if these people are going to behave this way, you pull back and be over here and don't get mixed up in that. And so one of the issues is, in the text, one of the objectives is to create pressure on the wayward brother. That's what it says in verse 14 at the end of the verse. Don't associate with him so that he may be put to shame. The whole idea there is to create pressure on the wayward brother to try to use whatever influence you have on them to get them to return to a clear conscience before God. The reason why I say that is because Paul was adamant in all of his letters and in his own life that if your conscience is violated, your life with God is in the toilet. It's not going to function. You can't operate by faith with a violated conscience. And so the whole point of creating this distance, according to verse 14, is that the brother who is refusing to be submissive to the tradition, that he'll be put to shame. And the issue of shame is the issue of refusing to allow a brother to ignore an enormous contradiction. Because by definition, a brother is somebody who's been born into the family. And all of our understanding of the New Testament, being born into the family of God, means that you accept as a fundamental reality the truth that is revealed in multiple places, but that is starkly presented in John 3:16. And that truth is that the God of the universe has made an enormous sacrifice beyond our comprehension, because nobody has ever explained how Jesus can be God and man simultaneously without any deficit in each area and then die, where you can't have death injected into the Godhead, but if death is not injected in that, then Jesus only dies as a man. If he dies as a man, then he can't be the Redeemer of humanity. So it's an enormous, complex mystery, but there's nothing mysterious about the fact that it was a sacrifice, a huge sacrifice. The fact that it's a mystery means it's over-the-top type huge. But the fact is, Jesus died for us, for our eternal life benefit. And that means that there is an automatic reciprocation built into it, that I cannot, therefore, refuse to make whatever sacrifices God calls on me to make for my temporal benefit. In other words, these people who are rejecting the traditions, they refuse to live by the tradition that is established, and the fundamental one is work so you can provide for yourself, as well as perhaps others too. The fact is, the refusal to do that is a refusal to sacrifice myself in order to follow the example that Christ set before us in his own personal sacrifice. It is a huge contradiction. I will take the benefits he offers, but I will not respond with any kind of gratitude or whatever. That's one of the issues of shame. It ought to make us ashamed if we think that we believe in Jesus' sacrifice for us, but we will make no sacrifice in response to that. It's a shame. But shame as a concept is an issue of the spirit of man, where the individual is not allowed to think that his or her brethren are going to accept their faithlessness toward God. Shame is, you're not behaving like you're supposed to behave, so get over there. I'm not having anything to do with you while you're acting this way. That's refusing to let the person who is rebelling accept the notion that this is somehow okay, because not. Rejection is because of rebellion, and the rejection is designed to create the shame issue. So, in the shame thing, verse 15 falls into play. You don't regard the person as an enemy, but you do admonish him as a fellow believer, brother. And the whole idea there is that the contact that you're not supposed to have in verse 14 is qualified by the contact that you are supposed to have in verse 15. You're not supposed to associate with him, but you are when you have any occasion to be with them. You are responsible to admonish them without buying into the notion that they're an enemy. In other words, a brother is supposed to be constantly confronted by rejection by the people of God, and he is supposed to be constantly confronted with the particular truths that are at the heart of the matter. One of the things that I've noticed about people who don't want to live according to the will of God and don't want to walk with him is it's a favorite ploy. They got it from being deceived by their adversary. It's a favorite ploy to try to get the conversation off topic so I don't have to deal with the real issue. It's kind of like you ask your little kid, did you knock the lamp off the table and break it? You know what happened at school the other day? It's a deliberate shift away from dealing with the issue. And that's the way it works. People, even not little kids, but grown-up adults do this. They'll shift the topic off of what's really at stake here, and what's really at stake here is, I know what God wants me to do, but I'm not going to do it. And that's the point that has to be pressed on. Cannot be allowed to be off topic. Because the word admonish here is a word that has been used by some in this 21st or 20th century to develop a concept they call nouthetic counseling. The word admonish is the word noutheteo in the Greek. But the idea of nouthetic confrontation is that you confront the real issue and you don't allow excuses or sidetrack, you know, rabbit trails. So that's what the issues of shame. The brother is to be constantly confronted with his totally irrational behavior, accepting such a great sacrifice on God's part without being willing to trust him with the rest of your dailies. And that's all it boils down to. I'm not going to trust him. I was trusting him when I got into this mess, and that just shows you the worthlessness of trust, that kind of mindset. So, that's the reverse order issue. It's at the bottom of verse 14 and part of 15. But the other issue is to disallow the rebel's pressure to pull oneself into the same hopeless spiral. In other words, verse 13, don't let the other brother's rebellion cause you to grow weary. Because that is almost automatic. If you retain a relationship, close relationship with somebody who's in rebellion against God, in a little while, you will get into a mess with them because their refusal to trust will cause you all kinds of anguish. In a little while, you'll lose hope, and then you'll be in. So you will become weary. Now, some people would think that if you're going to push the rebel away to keep yourself from being affected, that would be selfish. But it is not selfish to look out for your own spiritual health. Nobody can walk with God if their own spiritual health is being ignored. And you don't really walk with God fundamentally for yourself. You walk with God because He loved you and you love Him back. So the whole issue of walking with God is because He wants to walk with you and He wants you to walk with Him. And you have to look out for your spiritual health in that regard. Or if you don't, in a little while, you'll be one of those that has to be disassociated from because your example is pulling everybody down, sucking everybody down into this spiritual void. The fact is, leaven leavens. And we can't ignore that and remain spiritually healthy. Leaven leavens. Now, there is obviously a range, because none of us are perfect. None of us even come close to being perfect. And so you can't say, well, I'm not going to have anything to do with anybody that doesn't see things exactly my way. You can't say that, because if they did, you'd have two of these very imperfect people trying to get along with each other, and they couldn't. It's just impossible. The leaven that leavens issue, Paul used that term in two contexts, both of them at critical junctures. In Corinth, he didn't say that taking your brother to court before Gentiles should require that you kick that person out of the fellowship and because leaven leavens. He didn't say that. He didn't say in the Corinthian epistles that because you were disrupting the service by speaking in tongues and wouldn't shut up when it was somebody else's turn, that you ought to isolate that individual because they're just being selfish. He didn't say that. He said leaven leavens when he was talking about the guy who was living with his father's wife. That's a very high level of wickedness. And he said you can't tolerate that. In the Galatian letter, where he said leaven leavens, he wasn't talking about how you understand a whole lot of different things in relation to Scripture. He was talking about the essence of the gospel. He said, if you buy into this notion that the gospel is a merited issue where you perform your duties and God will accept you on the basis of your performance of His demands, if you buy into that, it will leaven you across the board, theologically. You cannot do that. So at the level of gross immoral behavior and at the level of gross theological error, leaven leavens. The fact is, leaven leavens anyway. Even the small issues are, finally, important. Even in this letter, 2 Thessalonians, he is talking about the hope of the rapture as a pre-tribulational reality. And in effect, he says, people that don't buy that, you need to put them at a distance from you. Most people say, the timing of the rapture is not that big a deal. Well, tell that to Paul. The issue is, in this context, he says, if anyone doesn't obey our instruction in this letter, and one of the instructions in this letter was, don't be deceived, chapter 2, verse 3, regarding the coming of the Lord for us and the coming of the day of the Lord to pour out wrath. So, we do have to have some understanding and some, what I've always called and got called on calling, the slop in the gears. You can't expect, especially with a dispensational orientation in theology, you cannot expect the gears to keep meshing exactly like they're supposed to after 2,000 years. There's going to be slop in the gears over time. And technically, all of the slop is going to cost you something. But you live where you live. So, love and leavens, and nobody can ignore the fact that love and leavens and still remain spiritually healthy. So what's the requirement? Well, it's the repetition we've already pointed out. Verses 14, verse 6. He commanded this. He commanded this. What's the problem? Well, verse 13 says the problem is that the brethren, the faithful brethren in Thessalonica who are working for a living and so on, the problem is that there's a very real possibility that they will grow weary. So that raises an issue of what's Paul think is going to cause them to grow weary of doing good? Well, that's such a general term, doing good. I mean, he said the same thing in Galatians 6, that you should not grow weary, that you should do good to all men. He says in 1 Corinthians 15:58, therefore be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Because you know that if you hang in there long enough, you will reap if you faint not. That whole idea. The point is, the phrase, don't grow weary doing good, has a context. The immediate context is the issue that we brought up in our introduction. You don't allow the unbelief of a fellow believer to cause you to become unbelieving. You don't grow weary of doing good when it doesn't look like it's doing any good in these cases. And quite frankly, that's one of the pastor's biggest challenges, because you never fixate on the people who are living like you'd like to see them live. You always fixate on the others that aren't. And that's where your attention always goes. And so if you happen to be one of those pessimists whose glass is always half empty, that's immediately, you're going to go, oh, it's just a waste of time. I'm just spinning my wheels. I'm going to quit all. And I've been there multiple times as a pastor. I'm going to quit. This is just not worth it. They ain't doing any good. And this is directly just obedient to this issue of not growing weary. And this is why burnout is the issue, because it's a direct contradiction. Don't grow weary. Well, how do you keep from it? Well, what causes it in the first place? What causes the weariness? Well, I've already said in my illustration of the great big bolt and the little bitty pliers, burnout is caused by having an impossible task and inadequate resources. And from a biblical point of view, neither one of those is a reality. God never commands us to do something that is outside of the scope of possibility, and he never leaves it up to personal resources. So you'll never have an impossible task with inadequate resources. The scriptures are extremely plain that God does not put us in situations that are beyond our capacity. You're never tempted beyond your ability. That means that God will actually oversee your life so that you will not have to face anything that you're not prepared for. That does not mean that you won't have to face things that you don't want to have to face. It means you won't have to face things that you're not already prepared for. And sometimes the preparation of God is right up to the very edge. You know, you feel like, oh, one more step and I'm going to go off the edge. Well, that's kind of like Saul. All my soldiers are leaving. I better offer this sacrifice. Samuel's not here. It's almost time. If he'd have waited another half hour, Samuel would have been there. So, what's going on here is, in this context, the reality is a very painful thing to be obedient to the command to have nothing to do with somebody that you care about. It's a very difficult thing. That by itself is almost enough to cause people to say, it ain't worth it. I'm not going to go there. I'm weary of all of this stuff. That's almost enough. But all that does is multiply the number of people that are rebelling against what God has said. Paul says, they don't keep putting these commandments, then mark them. Well, then you just join the group of those that are marked. It creates a very painful thing. I've been there many times in the pastorate where we ran into people who just bowed their neck. And there wasn't anything we could do about it except what the scripture said to do about it. And it just tears your soul. But nonetheless, that's one of the possible problem issues of growing weary. It's just, I don't want to have to feel this. And the outworking of that is the tendency to go into despair. So Paul says, don't. Don't grow weary. So then the issues of growing weary come to the forefront, and the question is, how do you keep from it? Well, let's just look at a few texts, and you can jot these down or you can just think along with me on them. But when you look at the term that's translated grow weary here, it's used by New Testament authors. Predominantly it's used by Paul in all but one case, and the other case is Luke, who was a sidekick of Paul. But nonetheless, it's regularly translated faint not rather than grow weary. And it's interesting that in Luke 18:1, it says Jesus told a parable so that men would always pray and not faint or grow weary. So obviously, prayer is a recourse to not growing weary. And according to Luke 18, you're always to pray so that you won't grow weary. And that implies life's going to be a constant challenge that cannot be met apart from praying. In 2 Corinthians 4, verse 1, Paul says, seeing we have this ministry, as we have received mercy, we faint not. Well, what was Paul's ministry? His ministry was getting beat up for telling people about the gospel. That was his ministry. We've received this ministry, so we're not going to faint. Well, all of that violence that was inflicted on his body was designed to get him to faint. And he said, not having it. We've received mercy. We're not going to faint. In the same book, same chapter, verse 16, he says, for which cause we faint not. But though our outward man perish, yet the inward is renewed day by day. And what he's talking about there has to do with how you respond when your outward man is perishing. As you get old, there's a strong possibility that you will get grumpy. Therefore, he says, we're not supposed to faint. There is enough grace, there is enough renewal grace, day by day, keep us from fainting, even though our outward man is perishing. In chapter 6 of Galatians, verse 9, it says, don't be weary in well-doing. In due season we'll reap if we don't faint, if we don't quit. Ephesians 3:13 says, I desire that you faint not at my tribulations for you, which is your glory. In other words, I don't want you getting all depressed because you've heard about all the stuff I'm having to suffer in order for you to have access to the truth. That'd be real discouraging. Think, yeah, in order for me to have this, he's got to go through all that stuff. He says, that's actually your glory. It just proves how important you are to me. So there are, at least in this letter, there are at least three things that are fainting issues or weary issues. And they are these. Paul said in first letter, chapter 3, verse 4, when we were with you, we kept telling you in advance that we were going to suffer affliction. In other words, buying into the gospel means you're going to have troubles. He says, we've told you this. So what happens if you start suffering for being faithful, and every time you're faithful, it causes you to suffer more? Well, over time, you get a little tired of it. And Paul says, don't grow weary in that kind of mindset. You know how Hebrews 12:4 addresses it? Get a life. You haven't suffered the blood yet. That's a Darrell paraphrase. But Hebrews 12:4 says, hey, the suffering is a part of it. Just don't let that tear you down, because you haven't even resisted to blood. Now, there have been lots of people who resisted way past blood to death. In fact, some pretty cruel ways of dying. How about being wrapped up in an animal's rotten animal skin and have wax poured all over you in a match lit? How'd you like to die that way? Well, that's what happened to some of them. So it kind of keeps an issue of perspective in mind. And I think the more spoiled we get, the more we lose our perspective. Painful hangnail for some people is enough to get all bent out of shape over. And they never stop to think about the, a hangnail. Seriously? I mean, look at all the ways. You know, worse than that. But since we live in a very relatively pain-free kind of environment, any kind of pain becomes an issue for growing weary. And you said, no. In this letter, enduring persecution as an inevitability tends to make you grow weary, so don't do it. Another issue is the one of this paragraph. Enduring faithlessness on the part of some believers requiring discipline is a part of the process. Don't let it get to you. Don't grow weary. And then, within this paragraph, there is this. Sometimes what other people need is going to require a lot of hard work on my part. That's what he said. We worked ourselves night and day to keep you from being burdened. And this is the pattern we set for you to do. In other words, it'd be a whole lot easier just to slip your feet under your brother's table and eat his food and not worry about it, because that's easy. Working night and day, that's hard. And I don't want to have to do that. Well, there are some things to be faithful to God where you have to be willing to labor night and day. There haven't been a lot of times in my experience where that's been the case, but there have been a few. When I was asked to teach at the grade school in North Carolina, I was already doing teaching and all that stuff for the church, and it was pretty well taking up my time. So I said to the school, yeah, I'll do that. And so I started getting up at 3:30 in the morning so I could get my work done before I went to teach school, because I knew when I got home I wasn't going to feel like doing anything. And that'll make you tired working night and day. So those are the three fundamental things that are in 2 Thessalonians. Enduring ongoing persecution, enduring ongoing faithlessness on the part of other believers, enduring the reality that sometimes needs have to be met by working way more than our 8-hour union, whatever it is. And of course, there's no union issue here, I assume. But the fact is, Paul is dealing with growing weary of doing good, and in the context, it has those particulars. But I think there is application beyond that. The whole issue is, the idea of fainting has a real interesting etymology. The word translated grow weary or faint actually literally means something that comes out of evil. Well, you have the word kakeo, which means to do evil. And then you have ek kakeo. It's to come out of evil. And the etymology, you can't just plug the etymology in here, because the idea of fainting or growing weary is the resultant word down the road. But the etymology is interesting on this point. Fainting is an out of evil production. Because fainting is allowing unbelief to triumph into despair so that God is both disappointed and antagonized, because it is evil. God doesn't want us giving up our confidence in Him. Yes, He's called us in some situations to a difficult task, but it is not an impossible task simply because He doesn't expect us to meet it in our own resources. He expects us to depend on His resources to meet it. And that's a tension. But nonetheless, that's the whole point of not growing weary of doing good. So, what's the solution? Well, part of the solution is remembering that the bottom line is the issue of shame. God made a beyond explanation sacrifice. It's beyond our comprehension. He made this sacrifice so that we could be forgiven and given eternal life. And we then have as an inherent obligation to make whatever sacrifices we have to make in order to be loving and hopeful and believing as a loyalty response to Him. Whatever the loyalty response to Him, whatever it costs. And then, as I've said multiple times and probably going to be saying a lot more until I die, don't forget Acts 2. The descent of the Spirit at Pentecost was a deliberate theological presentation of our helplessness and His willing to compensate for it. Despair is usually the result of attempting impossible things with inadequate resources, and we have a more than adequate resource to be loving and hopeful and believing in the Spirit of God. And whatever task He sets before us, we're supposed to be depending on the Spirit of God to enable us to do that. And Jesus' words in Luke 18 are appropriate there. We ought always to pray and not give up. So, next week, verse 16, maybe 17 and 18, and then we'll have to decide where we're going from there.